Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Welcome to The Conversation on this Aloha Friday, June 7th. 2023 proved to be a breakthrough year for Hawaii writers who garnered global recognition with their books thriving in the mainstream market. Recently, Honolulu Magazine recognized their work in the inaugural Honolulu Book Awards. Today, we hanaho our interviews with some of those winning authors. We spotlight University of Hawaii professor Craig Santos Perez, who won a National Book Award for his poems steeped in his native Guahan, also known as the Island of Guam. We sit down with Kamehameha School's graduate Megan Kakimoto, who embraces myth, contemporary Hawaiian identity, and womanhood. And Hula, the debut novel by Jasmine Iolani Hakes, dives into tradition and family. And we talk with author Chris McKinney, whose new sci-fi trilogy is set in a futuristic Hawaii. The Conversation Summer Reads starts after the headlines. Is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today we're sharing a Summer Reads Hanaho show inspired by Honolulu Magazine's inaugural Honolulu Book Awards. The celebration of local literature showcased local talent whose work has been picked up by national publishers, allowing their writing to be appreciated on a broader platform. Today we feature some of the conversations we had with some of those authors. For the first time ever, the prestigious National Book Award for Poetry was won by a Pacific Islander. This happened in November, and the honor went to Craig Santos Perez. He's a native of Guam and an English professor at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Full disclosure, he's also my nephew. Santos Perez made the trip to New York to accept the award in person. We talked to him about what that win meant, not just to him as a Chamorro, but to a culture that is often overlooked. In fact, he shared that over the years, he was told by publishers there wasn't a market for Pacific Island literature, much less about a tiny island the world knew little about. That night, he said he didn't think he would win and didn't prepare a speech, and at the last second, decided to read from his book entitled Unincorporated Territory, Amut. Here's Craig reading the last poem in his winning book during his acceptance speech.
I want to share this poem. It's called The Pacific Written Tradition. I returned home to Guam for the first time after 15 years away and visited an English class at one of Guam's public high schools. As I read aloud from my new book, I notice a student crying. "What's wrong?" I ask. She says, "I've never seen our culture in a book before. I just thought we weren't worthy of literature." How many young islanders have dived into the depths of a book only to find bleached coral and emptiness? We were taught that missionaries were the first readers in the Pacific because they could decipher the strange signs of the Bible. We were taught that missionaries were the first authors because they possessed the authority of written words. Today, studies show that Islander students read and write below grade level. It's natural, experts claim. Your ancestors were an illiterate oral people. Don't believe their claims. Our ancestors deciphered signs in nature, interpreted star formations and sun positions, cloud and wind patterns, wave currents, and ocean efflorescence. That's why master navigator Papa Mao once said, quote, "If you can read the ocean, you will never be lost," end quote. Now let me tell you about Pacific written traditions, how our ancestors tattooed their skin with defiant scripts of intricately inked genealogies, how they carved epics into hard wood with sharpened points, their hands and the pressure and responsibility of memory, how they stenciled petroglyphic lyrics on cave walls with clay, fire, and smoke. So the next time someone tells you our people were illiterate, teach them about our visual literacies, our ability to read the intertextual sacredness of all things. And always remember, if we can write the ocean, we will never be silenced. Thank you.
Congratulations, Craig.
That was Craig Santos Parrish reading a poem from his book, Unincorporated Territory, Amut. Amut is a Chamorro word for medicine, and his poems center on healing from colonialism, militarization, and environmental injustice. Guam, or Guahan, is an unincorporated territory of the U.S. where the struggles of political self-determination issues are still being fought. Residents of the island of Guam are U.S. citizens but don't have a vote in Congress. We share this rebroadcast of our interview with Perez.
You know, a Pacific Islander author has never won a National Book Award in any category. So I just assumed I wasn't going to win, so I didn't prepare a speech or anything. And so when they, you know, announced my book as the winner, I was pretty shocked. Was not prepared at all. It took me a couple minutes just to even stand up from the table and to walk on stage. And so once I started walking and finally got up there, then, you know, the moment kind of hit me and I was able to, you know, just thank the people I wanted to thank and to kind of made a last minute decision to read the last poem from my book. And yeah, it was just really great to be able to, you know, share a little bit about, you know, our culture and history to kind of the large national audience.
Well, you know, I love that the picture on the cover of the book is of, you know, Auntie Rose playing bingo, which is your grandmother. But maybe share with our listeners, you know, the meaning behind that.
Sure. So my grandmother, my paternal grandmother, you know, passed away a couple of years ago, and I wanted to write some poems in her honor and to just memorialize and, you know, offer respect to her life. And so there are several poems in the book about her, and one of those poems was a piece I wrote about her going to play bingo with her the last time I saw her when she was alive. And you know, I took some pictures of that as well, and my publisher was kind enough to allow me to feature that photo on the cover of the book. So it was really special to, you know, see her hands and have her on that screen and with me there in spirit, because she really did a lot to help raise me when I was growing up in Guam.
This is your fifth book, and your theme, you talk about, you know, colonialism, because being out in Guam, we were just taken over by, you know, the Spanish. You know, we were under the Japanese for a bit, and then the Americans took over, you know, during the Spanish-American War. But talk about the themes that you focus on.
Yeah, so, you know, throughout my career, I've been writing about, you know, the colonial history, politics of Guam, as well as, of course, issues relating to the environment. It's very important to me. Beyond that, you know, I've been writing about, you know, it's kind of the experiences, struggles, traumas, and triumphs of the Chamorro people. That, you know, includes themes such as, you know, migration and diaspora, kind of militarization, and just kind of reconnecting to our culture as well. And so those things kind of run throughout my books, and, you know, woven into those larger themes are, you know, stories of my grandparents, of family, as well as of just contemporary issues related to both climate change and, you know, one big issue in Guam and the Marianas, which is the military buildup, which has been happening for the last 15 years or so.
Well, you know, as I have been doing research and reading the accounts of explorers out in the Pacific, you know, I have come across a lot of the illustrations, you know, dating back to the, you know, 15, 1600s. And I love that you use some of that imagery in your books, pictures of the lattice stones, which are, you know, structures upon which we built our hales on top, our huts, and the canoe history, right? Because we were the one culture that the Europeans wrote about this idea of wayfinding and navigation, and they talked about, you know, the different types of canoes that the Chamorros had and the speed at which they were able to go to the Philippines using the proas. I mean, I don't know what it was like for you when you started exploring all of that history.
Yes, I had a similar feeling as I started to research and dive into the archives. You know, I was really struck by, you know, these archival images of canoes as well as of, you know, ancestral architecture. And, you know, of course, I was really interested in, you know, that period of not only colonial history, but, of course, kind of pre-colonial Chamorro culture. And, you know, in my poetry, I tried to weave together, you know, the past with the present And, you know, in that way, we can kind of, you know, create a more maybe spiraling or circular sense of time in which, you know, the past is always with us, and the present, you know, of course, is shaped by the past. And, you know, for me, thinking about the canoe as a symbol of navigation has been a very important metaphor. Just in my own life, trying to, you know, navigate, you know, being a writer, but also what it means to be Chamorro, what it means to migrate and to leave home, and, you know, of course, what it means to also be an activist and to, you know, kind of imagine different futures for Guam and for the Pacific.
And because, you know, you teach at the University of Hawaii, you know, what has the experience of the Native Hawaiians been, and what kind of influence has that, how has that affected, you know, your writing when you see some of these same issues come up, you know, whether it's in Guam or here in Hawaii?
Yes, I was fortunate to live in Hawaii for 12 years and, you know, got to know, you know, Hawaiian history and culture more intimately, and to kind of recognize, you know, both the shared history of U.S. colonialism, as well as to, you know, recognize, you know, many cultural similarities between Chamorros and Hawaiians, as well as, of course, shared struggles against, you know, things like militarization. And, you know, beyond Hawaii, of course, across the Pacific, there, you know, there are many similar issues. And, of course, one of the major ones being climate change today. And so, you know, through my work, I tried to map out those connections and to express my own solidarity with the Hawaiian people and, of course, with other Pacific Islanders.
And I understand that you've got another book in the works.
Yes, I have another poetry collection coming out next year. It has similar themes where, you know, I have a section of poems about Guam and Chamorro experience. I have another section in the book that makes connections between Guam and other parts of the Pacific. And then there are some poems as well that, you know, make kind of global connections between the Pacific and Native America, or things happening in Palestine and as well as kind of around the world. And so, yeah, I'm looking forward to that book. It's titled Mutiny. And so it takes on similar themes of navigation and politics.
And I remember going to the UN building there in New York and seeing one of your early books there. And I was like, wow, that's pretty awesome.
Yes, I was able to go to the United Nations New York headquarters, I believe in 2008, where I was able to present testimony about Guam's colonial history and some of the impacts of militarization. And I testified in front of the Fourth Committee, which is a committee on decolonization, along with a couple other Chamorro activists. And as you know, there's a long history of Chamorros going to the United Nations. And, you know, of course, many have continued to do so as just another platform through which to advocate for our international rights to self-determination and sovereignty.
And talk about poetry, why you chose, you know, this genre to find your story and tell the story of Guam.
I started writing poetry more seriously when I was in high school. This is when my family first migrated from Guam to California. And at that time, poetry became a space for me to express my thoughts and emotions about leaving home, about feeling really, really homesick, and, you know, trying to stay connected to our culture. You know, I just found poetry to be a very powerful kind of creative form through which to articulate emotion. And, you know, as I became an adult and learned more about, you know, colonialism and, you know, became more radicalized, then I started, you know, discovering that poetry is also a very powerful form through which to express political opinions, as well as a way to honor, you know, my ancestors and where I come from.
You were there on that big stage sharing Guam's story. How do you hope your win will resonate with the younger generation?
Yeah, that's an important question to me because, you know, when I first started publishing my work, that was, you know, kind of my mission is really to inspire, you know, other Pacific Islander authors, because at that time I was receiving a lot of rejections from publishers because, you know, they said they would never be able to sell my book. Because they've never heard of Guam or Chamorro people, and two, because there's really no market for Pacific Islander literature at the time. And so, you know, for me being on that stage and receiving the National Book Award, you know, I hope will inspire other Pacific Islanders to know that, you know, there are people interested, you know, in our stories, and that, you know, that it's important for us to continue to tell our stories and histories and cultures, you know, to not only inspire our own peoples, but also, of course, to raise awareness on a national and global audience about our stories.
And I know you have mentioned about how much it means to you to share our history with your kids, you know, with your daughters, knowing that we have come from this tiny island out in the middle of the Pacific, and you can make your mark out there. Anything else you want to add about that?
When they're older, they'll read my works and learn more about that part of their genealogy. And, you know, they could hopefully learn more about their tomorrow grandparents as well, since I tell a lot of my grandparents' life stories in the book. And, you know, unfortunately, they didn't get to meet all of their great-grandparents. And, you know, because they live in Hawaii, so, you know, it would be nice for them to learn, you know, more about that other part of their ancestry, and maybe someday I'll be able to take them both to Guam, where they can connect to that part of their culture as well.
All right. Well, Craig Santos Perez, thank you so much. I have learned a little bit more about you that I didn't know as an auntie, but thank you so much. We're so proud of your accomplishment.
Well, thank you, Auntie. Your pride and, you know, the pride that other folks have said they felt when I did accept the award, you know, means the world to me. And so thank you for this opportunity.
All right. Aloha and tutu'is masi.
Tutu'is masi.
That was UH Professor Craig Santos Perez, winner of the National Book Award for Poetry. The book is a collection of poems about Guam entitled Unincorporated Territory, Amut. It recently won in the Honolulu Book Awards for Poetry.
Let me tell you a story of an angel I met, strong as the sunrise, soft as the sunset.
Megan Kamale Kakimoto is of Japanese Hawaiian descent. She is the author of Every Drop is a Man's Nightmare, a short story collection that explores Native Hawaiian myth, love, and family. Her book was a USA Today national bestseller, and she's received fellowships from the Breadloaf Writers Conference and the Michener Center for Writers. She talked to former HBR producer Stephanie Hahn about writing through a feminist lens.
To me, it's a very clear focus. You're a feminist writer, and that is very obvious. So I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Yeah, I am so grateful for that reading. I set out with these stories writing only women protagonists at different places in their life, different stages of their life. I was just noticing all these threads, these common threads that were popping up in different stories that sort of kept asserting themselves to me. And my interest early on, before I even thought of this as a collection, but just as I was writing stories, was being able to write into a woman character in her body, what it looks like, what it feels like to be in a body and to possess a body in a world that's not always welcoming or accommodating of your body. And I think writing these women felt like an opportunity to be very fearless, to sort of track them as they live their lives, don't always make the right choices. They don't have to do the right thing or, you know, behave a certain way in accordance to what society expects of them or wants of them. I think there's a joy in representing women and the full range of their humanity. And the moments when women in these stories kind of chose kindness and compassion for each other and for their bodies and their world were just as enjoyable for me to write as, you know, the moments when they were a little messy and made the wrong choice. And as a writer and as a reader, I really gravitate towards stories that offer all characters, but especially the women characters, the space to be as human as they need to be. So that was, I think, a commitment for me in writing each of these stories.
You speak to a local audience. You speak to a woman of Hawaiian descent experience, but you're also half Japanese. And so how does this figure into your construction of womanhood? Is there a difference? What's the same? A lot of it is citing a matrilineal narrative, the knowledge that comes from your matriarchal line. But is there anything about womanhood that also comes potentially from your patriarchal line?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I, like you mentioned, my Japanese side is on my father's side, and I am incredibly close to that side of my family as well. I think a lot of what I've encountered or wrestled with in some ways has been a pressure or a stress to sort of make sure that I'm not telling quiet stories or not being too quiet, that I'm able to tell these stories in the truest way that I can and that I know how to. I think that there's elements of growing up half Japanese and sort of with my Japanese family that is a little on the quieter side, on the private side. One of the most freeing things about writing is that you can write into whatever character you want to write into, and have, there's a safety there, I think, in being able to tell a story. I guess for zooming out a little bit, you know, I'm kind of a people pleaser in my daily life pretty significantly, but when I'm writing a story, my character does not need to be a people pleaser, and they can be really sort of feisty, or you know, they can not give a damn about what they are or how they behave with other characters, and I think there's just a lot of freedom in being able to take comfort in the page that way and tell those sorts of stories, especially when, you know, you consider maybe the context of a cultural expectation of being a little more on the private or quiet or meeker side.
Right now, there's a lot of discussion about Indigenous women's knowledge in particular and how they're leading a discussion about the environment. What elements of women's knowledge and wisdom do you think are important that people should pay attention to? What is it, if we're in leadership positions, might potentially be different for our world?
I guess I can only speak to my own, like, personal experience as being a woman. I think that I see a lot of really sort of attending to compassion in my own community of women friends and women family members. I think leading with compassion has been, you know, kind of, it has been very important to me in my own life, and also having an eye for empathy. I feel like I get both when I am in community with my women friends, and I feel like that's very top of mind for a lot of women in my life, and for me as well. And I think that those are two things that would make the whole world better, but especially in politics today and in so much that's going on right now, just lending that eye toward compassion and having sort of an awareness of other people. And, you know, when I say empathy, I don't at all mean to, you know, make excuses for anyone else or anyone's bad behavior. I think it's more just taking the opportunity to regard where that person is coming from, what experiences they're bringing to their own, you know, opinion or their own actions. And I guess just, yeah, having that be top of mind.
What was your biggest struggle with writing that you feel that you overcame while writing this book as a writer? You know, sort of a writerly piece of advice that you might give to aspiring writers out there.
I don't even know if I've overcome it yet, but I think it's a process of constantly overcoming, but not being silenced by the fear of, you know, there's so much fear in writing and putting any piece of writing out into the world. But I think an Indigenous Hawaiian story collection that has a feminist bent, you know, I think that there's a lot of fear in how these stories will be received, even down to the title, you know, Every Drop is a Man's Nightmare. I've had someone ask me if I worried about alienating male readers from the title. And I mean, my honest answer is no. But I think just at the same time, there is just a lot of, there's always a lot of fear. And I had a lot of anxiety in terms of, in particular, writing these cultural narratives, because there is an incredible amount of pressure from, I think, anyone in a marginalized experience to do right by their community, because there's so few of us getting published, there's so few of us having our work championed, and there's that pressure to get things right and to, you know, do right by the Hawaiian community. I am constantly thinking about that and also trying very hard not to worry about that, because at the end of the day, I can only write into my own experience, and there is no single monolithic Hawaiian cultural experience that I can ever accurately represent. So I think trying to pay attention to my own experiences and to have the confidence in putting these stories out and really try not to worry about how they're going to be received, because ultimately I needed to write the stories, and that has been done. Again, it is also very much a learning, ongoing learning process for me.
Thank you so much for coming by. Really appreciate it. I think that any listener out there would really enjoy this book. It's a fantastic collection.
Thank you so much, Stephanie.
Thanks.
That was author Megan Kamale Kakimoto talking to HBR Stephanie Hahn. The segment originally aired last September. Her book, Every Drop is a Man's Nightmare, is a collection of short stories that won Author Under 35 in the Honolulu Book Awards.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, with a mission to provide fresh water to the people of Oahu, committed to conserving and protecting Oahu's water resources since 1929. BoardofWaterSupply.com. This summer, enjoy live jazz music at HPR's Atherton Studio. Our Hawaii Jazz Performance Series presents Hot Club of Hulaville, featuring Kelsey Armstrong, the Tommy James Trio, Arara Givento, and Eha Batutas. HPR will record these performances for future broadcasts and online viewing. Learn more at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Farm Lovers Markets. Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company, and Furniture Plus Design.
Hula is the name of Jasmine Iolani Hakes' debut novel. It tells of a coming-of-age story of a young woman aspiring to compete in the Mary Monarch's Miss Aloha Hula competition. It also explores the relationship that Hawaiians have with the cultural art form and how one finds identity within a family and its history. Hakes grew up in the Keokaha area in Hilo. She also spent many years with Halau o Kekuhi and put herself through college as a professional luau dancer. The Conversation's Russell Subiano talked with Hakes about what inspired her to write the book.
In your book, you really explore how bloodlines and relationships impact identity. Is that something that you wrestled with or that fascinated you growing up?
Both, very much so. I think, You know, I was born at home. And so the running joke was that if I hadn't been, you know, my mom never would have believed that I was hers because I'm so fair and I have these blue eyes and it looked so different from the rest of the family. And so growing up, I was very self-conscious of that. And also add that to my middle name and me being very aware of the responsibility of that name and being given that name of how do I reconcile these two things? Because in my mind, I don't look like what I think I should be in order to fulfill this responsibility in some way, right? As a hula dancer or as someone who does something as a gift to this culture and to where I'm from. And so I wrestled with that a lot because I just felt like, is my white skin something that means I'm not from here? And I think also growing up in the 80s and 90s where you had leading up to the apology bill, all those protests, right? And so it was like the first time you drive down the street and it was like, Hales, go home. And I'm like, do they mean me? And like, if they do, then where am I going to go? I've never, you know, and I used to ask my mom, like, well, what am I? Because that's our capital, right? That's how we communicate. And she would say, you're cosmopolitan. And she would said that since when I was a kid of like, you're a citizen of the world. And I was like, no, Ma, that's not what I like. That's not helpful. You know, yeah. I need something more tangible than that. What am I? And she would say, well, you're all these different things. And my grandpa would say, you know, you're Puerto Rican and Filipino and all those people that came to Hawaii to work sugarcane and all those things. But also, you know, like he would say, we are Hawaiian. It's just not on our birth certificate. And I thought, well, I can't claim any of those things if they're not on my birth certificate. And in Hawaii, that's such a big deal. And I knew it was, but I didn't ever want to ask, what am I if I don't have those things on there? You know, and I think that really, really stuck with me of where you belong. If it's not clear, if you don't have that birth certificate to say I'm from France and I'm French and easy. And then you go from there as far as developing your individual person. And so it really, really bothered me for a long time of that. And I think the book was a way for me to finally have the courage to explore that fear and that vulnerability. But what it turned into ultimately was more of a like, well, if I don't have that on my birth certificate, what is my cultural responsibility to where I'm from, to my home and to my children, right? I have one child that has it on her birth certificate and one that doesn't. So is their cultural responsibility and their cultural inheritance different? And I don't know, I only have questions, but I think it was a way, a very vulnerable way, but also a way to ask the questions that I know there's not really clear answers to. And everybody might say something different about it. You know, there's no book to refer to, just to look that question up.
Right.
Go, oh, okay, easy, you know.
Right. And there's no established guidelines either. I feel like maybe sometime in the future, maybe there should be some Hawaiian leaders and maybe some fair-skinned Hawaiians that kind of talk about that. And how do we change our mindset so that we're not just looking at everybody's color of their skin all the time?
And I think, and so it was really super scary because, I mean, it's something we all have feelings about, right? And so I was like, well, I'm just putting myself out there, you know, in front of this firing squad because it is something that is very relevant to current day politics. And there's so many implications to any way you look at it, right? But I also feel like what I had to do was I had to understand how we got here. And so I was being given from my aunties, like old journals where, you know, they would like missionaries or people that would come over to Hawaii, they draw, this is what a Hawaiian looks like. This is what the nose looks like. This is how dark their skin is. And then the introduced blood quantum thing. And we've so, not just in Hawaii, but around the world, we've so internalized that kind of thinking of we don't even define ourselves. We're just going off of this definition that's been given to us. And it's not necessarily just my problem. It's also like my problem for one of my best friends who inherited her place in line for Hawaiian homelands, finally gets it, spends all her resources and attention trying to build the house and meet, you know, keep the lease, and her kids don't have enough quantum to inherit it. And so then what, you know? And so we just keep accepting this definition that's been given. And so again, I don't have any like, well, here's what we should do going forward, how to fix it. But it was good, I think, for me to understand where my angst, my personal angst about what's on my birth certificate and what isn't, where that came from, you know, yeah. And it is heartbreaking. And what I didn't expect was to hear from so many people in America that have reached out to me that say, I look haole. And I've always been so self-conscious to say I'm Hawaiian, even if it's on my birth certificate, because I wasn't born there. And so who is Hawaiian enough? You know, is that just a small few? And if so, then how do we help them keep this culture alive if we have no responsibility? You know, so I just had all these like, well, I care, and this is my home. And so how, and I see all like my family and my community, and you must see this too. Like now so many people are finding ways, right, to like make it a better place and make it more community, yeah, and start businesses and do all these things. And so I guess this was my attempt to contribute to that a little bit, to that like, well, let's move forward. And how do we do that is maybe just understanding a little bit of what mess got us here.
There's a lot of context in your novel as well. You include a lot of accounts of Hawaiian history. There's like this new wave of books from local authors coming out that are telling these stories that are rooted in real life experiences and also interweave Hawaiian history. What was your decision behind including Hawaiian history in your novel?
For me, I didn't want to, I'm not a historian. And if I had told myself I was setting out to do what Hula eventually became, I would have laughed it off because I felt so unqualified to write something like that with that kind of scope. But when I wrote the simple story of this Naupaka family and their tensions and what they were struggling to reconcile and what the differences were between perspective of generations, I didn't have the liberty to assume a mainstream reader or even somebody from Hawaii would fully understand the history or the context of what they're fighting about. You know, like you can talk about certain peoples and you don't have to explain why they're angry or disenfranchised. But I think for a lot of people in Hawaii, you do. Most people around the world, at least people that I've met and come across, crossed paths with, you know, throughout my travels and stuff, they don't have any concept of anything. And I don't blame them. When I was growing up, I was in school anyway, in public school, I learned only the year Hawaii became a state. We covered it in one day, in one sentence, and that's it, you know? And so I felt like I wanted to get into it. I wanted to not have to hold back all the nuance and complications and stuff like that. And in order to do that, I had to build it out.
Over the last few years, we've seen more and more stories about Hawaii by Hawaiians and the people who live here that share a starkly different reality than those on the outside have been brought up to believe. We've seen it in movies, we've seen it in television and in books. What would you like readers to take away from your novel?
I think primarily the key thing that a reader, a mainstream reader, somebody outside of Hawaii could take away from this is the simple paradigm shift of Hawaii is not a destination. It's a place. And it doesn't mean you don't go there. But when you're visiting a place, you read up about it. You go with kind of open eyes. You want to visit things and you kind of walk, at least in general, I feel like you walk with a slightly softer step and be aware of a culture and be in awe of it and want to learn about it. And people don't do that when you're going to a destination, right? You think, I'm going to relax. I'm going to read this book and I'm going to get a tan. And that's your benchmarks for what you want out of Hawaii. And so if you read this and you just come away with going, wow, I'm going to a place versus a destination, I think that's a huge, small thing.
Thanks so much for your time, Jasmine.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That was author Jasmine Iolani Hakes talking with HPR's Russell Subiono. Her first novel, Hula, was awarded Honolulu Magazine's Book of the Year about Hawaii and is available through HarperCollins Publishers and all major booksellers. We originally aired this interview in July of 2023. The Honolulu Book Awards named Chris McKinney Author of the Year. His credits include Tattoo and Queen of Tears. When COVID hit, he decided to make a left turn and jump into science fiction. His latest work, Sunset Water City, is part of a sci-fi trilogy. We sat down with McKinney to talk about his work and those who influenced him.
Genre fiction was not encouraged at all when I was going to school. And I think at a certain point, I finally developed the confidence and sort of just being more aware of how the industry works, where it's sort of, I should try genre. And my favorite has always been, since I was a little kid, probably sci-fi. That, and I was at a point where, you know, this, I don't know, everything felt, because this is sort of like pandemic era, and, you know, you're looking at the state of the world and everything that you thought might be impossible is not impossible. And it was just so stunning. And I think a part of it was sort of the lockdown and just not wanting to write about the world in its present state and sort of pressing my imagination to speculate, you know, what all of this looks like 100, 150 years in the future.
So some of it was maybe a little escapism?
Some of it was, yes, definitely some escapism involved. Yeah.
So talk about the themes. I mean, talk about Hawaii, kind of fast forward, right?
Yeah. It's sort of like set in indistinguishable Hawaii, way in the future. And Hawaii is sort of like this bridge between the Pacific, between Asia and the mainland U.S. And it's basically one vast underwater city that is off the coast of the Big Island. And as far as, you know, just the way I came up with this concept was just weirdly just observing what was around me at the time. I'd been spending some time on the Big Island and TMT, the protests and all. I mean, that was big. And so that influenced the idea a lot. I was living in Kaka'ako too at the time. And, you know, I'm living, you know, in this condo, this glass tower, and I'm looking at Ala Moana Beach and the ocean. And I'm just sitting there and thinking, what if we took all of this, flipped it upside down and put it underwater? So the ideas sort of developed that way, just through things that I had been looking at. And the concept, the overall concept, what I was interested in doing was sort of blending genres and blending cultures in the story. Exploring that interested me because, I mean, Hawaii is totally fusion, right? And I wanted to explore this idea of, for example, in one book, blending murder mystery with science fiction, in the next book, blending adventure and some horror with sci-fi. And in the last book, I blend fantasy into the mix. And it's just sort of like, I don't really see people doing that much in fiction. So I wanted to try to do something different with the understanding that it might not be that palpable at first. So you remember when Roy's became the rage, right? This sort of Asian pan fusion food and stuff like that. I remember like the old school people like being, this is not for me.
It.
Yeah. If I'm going to eat Chinese food, I want, you know, traditional Chinese food or traditional Korean food. And I'm trying to do the same thing with the fiction, is just sort of blending things, knowing that, you know, it might not immediately sound appealing to some people who are more traditional in their thinking, but what they're not really thinking about is all of those cuisines that they're talking about. They're all products of fusion, too.
Yeah, I mean, what you got to lose, right?
Yeah. So,
well, the fact that you're, I guess, innovating, right? I mean, the whole world was turned on its head during the pandemic, so it really gives you the license to just try it, see where it goes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I heard you give a talk recently, and you made mention of how tapping into the sci-fi world of sci-fi readers just gave you just a whole nother stage to present your work.
Yeah, I mean, this is an art first and foremost, but you want to make money doing it. So, and of course, in this situation, money comes from the amount of readers that put their eyes on your work. So I felt like doing genre actually gave me more opportunity to get more eyes on this book and this trilogy, because people who are just in general sci-fi fans or speculative fiction fans, it might come across their feed, what they read and stuff like that. And, you know, it was an opportunity to maybe get more readers than I did with my older stuff that was set in Hawaii and felt very much for the Hawaii reader.
Yeah. Local stories.
Local stories, yeah.
For local people, local readers.
Yeah.
So was it difficult to find a publisher at first time out?
Well, it's actually, it wasn't that bad because the publishing company, Soho Press, who published the Water City trilogy, actually republished The Tattoo and The Queen of Tears, my first two books, back in like the early 2000s. So those two books were first published by Mutual Publishing here in Hawaii. And then Soho picked up the mainland rights for both of those books. And then when I was thinking about finding a publisher, I talked to Don Wallace, and he was, why don't you just ask Soho, because you had already worked with them. And so I approached them, and they liked the first book. So I was lucky.
And it isn't always that easy for writers to break in.
No. And even for me, it's sort of like it doesn't guarantee me anything when it comes to future books that I write. I mean, the process starts again, right? I can write something now and Soho gets first look because that's what the contract is. But they can easily say no. And then it's sort of like starting from ground zero again. And it's just oftentimes extremely difficult. And there's no guarantees. Unless, you're Stephen King or whatever. Then, you can write books that you don't even remember writing. Like he said once that he doesn't even remember writing Cujo. A lot of those books in the 80s, because he was just, going
pretty nuts. Prolific.
it's the first sort of famous image of him. He lived in Maine, and I mean, he had a crazy cocaine problem, and all he'd do is do a bunch of cocaine and drink a prolific amount of Budweiser. And that was his 80s. So he just cranked. If you think about how many books he wrote in that time period.
Manic.
Yeah, a decade-long manic, just sitting in his house in Maine, just book after book.
So I guess what's your advice then to writers out there? Don't be afraid, just try it?
Yeah, and it's sort of like when it comes to audiences, whether it be books or, streaming or whatever, it's very segmented. And I think it's almost in a way, I don't want to necessarily say tribal, but you can put fans in groups and the things that they sort of like. And they have more of the ability because of technology to sort of just sift and just find that thing that they're a fan of. I think it would be smart to be aware of that for anybody who's a young writer and think about, okay, what group are you trying to tell a story for? Because it's very rare to sort of write a book where it's just for the general public. I don't know if that really exists anymore, this concept of the general public.
Okay, so I just picked up your most recent book, but what else are you working on?
I'm trying to write something with my daughter, my older daughter, who's at Bryn Mawr. She's majoring in creative writing, and we're playing with fantasy. And I think the idea is we want to sort of blend this sort of almost Western genre with the Japanese samurai vibe, and we'll see what happens. But it's fun because, she's 4,000 miles away now, and it's just sort of like, it's yet another reason for us to keep in touch. And
nice way to connect with your kid.
Yeah, she's smart. So she's very imaginative. So it's fun. It's so isolating when you do it by yourself, which is fine. And I'm not complaining about that. That's just the reality of it. But it's interesting to collaborate once in a while.
And so who influenced you? Was there somebody, a teacher or someone who encouraged you to write?
Yeah. So I didn't even, I grew up in Kahalu. There's no writers in, So it's just sort of like I might as well have thought, I want to become an astronaut or something. It was that foreign to me. When I was at UH, I majored in English. I didn't take any creative writing classes, really. And, I thought, like most people do, I guess, that, once I finish my bachelor's degree, I'm going to get a job. I was a valet and doorman at the Pacific Beach Hotel while I was getting my degree. I was a valet and doorman at the Pacific Beach Hotel after I got my degree, right? So now I'm like, oh, no, now what? So I thought, okay, I'm going to go to law school. But I didn't. I messed up here and there during undergrad. So I said, okay, I'm going to get a master's degree in English. And then that'll, I'll get a high GPA in that and then whatever, apply to law school after that. That's when I first started taking creative writing. And the three professors that were huge for me were Joy Marcella, Ian McMillan, and Phil Damon. And Joy was the first one. And actually, what she was teaching was more of a creative nonfiction class. And so I had just written up this almost semi-mini memoir about what it's like to grow up in Kahalu as in an Asian family in the middle of basically a Hawaiian enclave. And yeah, so I wrote that. She really loved it. I mean, she said, tour de force. I was like, what? I didn't even know what tour de force meant. And I was like, right on. And then I started taking fiction, and Ian McMillan and Phil Damon were super encouraging. And Ian was the one who actually I had written the tattoo as my master's thesis. And he said, why don't you send it to Mutual Publishing? And so I sent it, and yeah, they were interested, and they published it.
I guess it's write what you know, right?
Yeah, I think, yeah, especially for young writers, right? Yeah, it's just sort of like, that's your material. It becomes challenging when you think about it sort of in the career sense. So, you know, that first book or, you know, one or two books, especially the first one, it can definitely be semi-autobiographical, and the audience will likely feel the realness of it, the authenticity of it. After you sort of expend that material, it's the next stuff where you really have to sort of press your imagination, ask yourself what you're interested in, what you want to write about. I think that's why, you know, in music, right, there's that term sophomore slump for the sophomore album, is because they spent so many years sort of cultivating that first album, working on that first album, and, you know, using up all of their past experience and instilling it in that first thing, that it, when it comes to the second, it's like, now what?
Now what? To have that challenge and to rise to the occasion. That was author Chris McKinney, who just released the latest in a trilogy. McKinney points to George Orwell's book, 1984, as one of his favorite sci-fi books. In a nod to summer reads, we've been featuring a Hanaho show of Honolulu Book Award winners. McKinney took home Author of the Year honors. That does it for today's special showcase of our summer reads. What's in your book bag? Let us know. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you missed any of the show or are looking for a past one, find them all on the conversation page of our website. Sign up for the Conversation podcast on Spotify, Google, or Apple. Our program is produced by Russell Subiono, Lillian Song, and Maddie Bender. Alicia Salcido is our summer intern. The Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. The music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday for more of The Conversation.